Well, welcome to Adventures in Artslandia. I'm really thrilled to be backstage at Portland Center Stage with Hershey Felder, who right now is doing his Irving Berlin show here.
Through the 30th of December a sing-along of the Great American Songbook on the 31st New Year's Eve. So I'll be here for another 4 weeks.
Oh, that's wonderful. What a thrill. What a great opportunity for our city to see this wonderful show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So Trevor just told me, your director, that you're also concurrently working on a Tchaikovsky piece that's going to be opening in 2017.
We actually open in exactly 4 weeks, mm-hmm. Or begin previews in exactly 4 weeks, mm-hmm. on the 11th of January. And yeah, the day is spent with Tchaikovsky, and the evening is spent with Irving Berlin. Two people of very much so Russian heritage,
yes.
But at the same point, two opposite ends of the stick, that's for sure.
Yes. I've been an Irving Berlin fan for, as long as I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot of Pops concerts and
sure.
things like that. And I think his songbook is remarkable. And while I don't know the songs that you're singing in the show, I know a little bit about Irving Berlin and in his life and his first marriage. And I'm just so drawn to his ballads. And I wonder if there's one that you could speak to that really speaks to you.
Well, I mean, they're all sort of miraculous, but
mm-hmm.
I think What'll I Do is one of those that you think, this is really perfect. How is it possible that he never studied music
mm-hmm.
and didn't understand how to actually write notes
mm-hmm.
and yet craft something with such perfect shape and form and at the same time communicate something so simply and so directly and so elegantly, you know, for a man whose English was his second language, of course, because
mm-hmm.
he spoke Russian and Yiddish, I guess,
mm-hmm.
first, maybe third language, I guess, English. And to say things like, what'll I do with just a photograph to tell my troubles to? And the image is right there. And this is what he was brilliant at. He was easily captured the essence of humanity and who we are as Americans,
mm-hmm.
Who people are, by the most direct use of language that ultimately becomes very poetic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great lesson in writing, is that it doesn't have to be florid and not understandable in order for it to be art. The purer the form, the purer the directness of the work, somehow the more touching and the more eternal. I mean, if you look at all the great works of, if you go Shakespeare and Chekhov and whoever, they're all human.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what Berlin managed to capture in his work. He managed to capture humanity that is very, very endearing, but also very personal.
Yes, the directness speaks to me because I would imagine, as English being his second language, that strong images hit him and then he would capture those in a direct way. You know, sometimes when I would think if English was his first language, he might have been more florid, as you said, or, you know, he captured it.
Well, it's
very,
very
potently.
Well, it's a very interesting thing to look at what's going on today, you know, with equally as interesting, you know, with Lin-Manuel Miranda and,
mm-hmm.
you know, this onslaught of so much language.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Irving Berlin would be very interesting to give a master class in, it'd be fun to put those two together and just Irving Berlin say, what, far too many words, far too many words, you know. Irving Berlin's essence was capturing an entire emotion and an entire idea in the least amount of words,
mm.
which is something that I believe in, you know. I mean, at some point you have to tell a story, and but there's never a line in Irving Berlin that doesn't mean something.
Mm.
And what made creating a play and crafting a piece with his music in such a way that it's not just a hit parade or a bunch of songs or a review, a jukebox musical, that's
mm-hmm.
what they call it, is that each of his pieces tell a complete story. And then the secret was actually telling a complete story within a much larger complete story. But you're never stuck with Berlin with a song that kind of goes on and sort of says the same thing 17 times. There's not one like that.
Right.
Each one advances as it tells a story, and you learn more about the characters involved or about the motion he's telling you. So it's, you know, he was a genius.
He was, and what amazes me about his work is his ability to be so facile and comedic and heartfelt, you know. And being Jewish myself and also having a Russian heritage, I think that there is this ability. I mean, his life was absolutely tragic in so many ways, and yet he lived a very, very happy life. It seemed as his second marriage was blessed, and he had children, and he. How do you?
Well, almost. He lost one along the way, right? You know, which is a great tragedy. I mean, you can imagine a parent, and as tragic as it is to lose a child, and you know, nothing, no parent should ever have to go through it. Mm-hmm. There's something about losing a child to SIDS, you know, mm-hmm. That somehow leaves the parent with, and I've heard this from a number of parents who've lost a child that way. Leaves the parent with, could I have done something? As opposed to, you know, God forbid a child gets sick and we did everything possible and there was just, this was God's will or whatever, but just this sort of weird thing in the middle of the night, a child goes to sleep and doesn't wake up.
And it could was I on have Christmas, done? Wasn't it?
Yeah, Christmas morning, mm-hmm. which is the essence of why White Christmas means so much to him. Mm-hmm. And of course, every Christmas morning for the rest of he and Ellen's life, they went to the little boy's burial place, which is sort of remarkable, a three-year-old child. So, you know, I think he had this ability to really connect with his own emotions, and he wasn't afraid of them. And, you know, he had a miraculous life, lots of ups, lots and downs. You know, I mean, being blessed, of course he was blessed, but then again, the most complicated thing is the world passed him by when he was 76 years old or at that point. Mm-hmm. He becomes a complete recluse. And for many people, they'd sort of, you know, fail away over the next 3 or 4 years in the 80s, early 80s. He lived another 26 years. Mm-hmm. That's a lifetime for a lot of people in terms of art. Mm-hmm. And to have that kind of artistic and musical commitment and capacity and not be able to employ it or be heard for 26 years when you were number one for the 60 years prior. Complicated. Yeah. So I do know from his family that, no, this was not easy for him.
Mm. Now, he continued to write a song a day. I know, I've read that. Well, a song a day.
I don't know that he wrote a song a day, but he wrote songs. He didn't stop until the end, and there is a last one somewhere that I saw. Mm-hmm. And Linda, his middle daughter, who I'm very friendly with, and Robert Kimball, also a friend in New York, who... did the Gershwin book, and also spoke to Berlin every day for the last 20 years of his life. Never met him face-to-face, only spoke to him on the telephone. Mm. They put together a book of these lyrics, known and unknown, and it's a beautiful publication.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I have to look for that. So I'm just curious, do you have in the show, how do you do it, Mabel, on $5 a week?
No, I have a quote from one of those songs, because there are a bunch of them, you know, say, Salome, go home, and...
Call me up on a rainy... Yeah,
well, there's a whole bunch of them, Cohen owes me $97, all these. And so the quote that I have is, if you want my peaches, you better stop shaking my tree.
That's great.
Mary Snow had a beau, mm-hmm. you know. And so those Lower East Side songs are really remarkable mm-hmm. and great fun. And maybe how you do it on $5 a week is, I mean, very naughty. But then again, he was known for that. You know, in the early days, he made his money by parodying popular songs and making them extremely blue. Mm. I keep on asking the kids if somewhere there are copies of these really filthy songs. Mm-hmm. But so far, they haven't given them to me. So. Mm. I think the bet most you get is, Mabel, how do you do it on $5 a week?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, it's the Irving Berlin songbook is just remarkable.
Sorry, I didn't get that.
Oh, Siri just
decided to make an appearance.
That was good. Maybe if Irving Berlin was still alive, he'd definitely write a song about Siri. No question about it.
Well, I think he'd be horrified, but anyway.
So in regard to his directness, I was thinking about Ethel Merman, and I thought, wow, they must have been, how did they get along? Do you know much about their relationship?
Well, I think he found Ethel Merman to be he calls her in this play a steamship foghorn. I think it was like all of those relationships in those days. They were love-hate relationships. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, he obviously valued her because, you know, she was his number one star for a number of things, certainly for that show. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, but she was big time with the Gershwins.
Right.
You know, but I think he was more, if you'd want to talk about artists that he felt really connected to, I think Fred Astaire was more his representational style, sort of a quiet elegance.
Mm.
I think Ethel Merman was, if you forgive me, balls to the wall.
Right, she was.
Yeah,
it was fun reading a little bit about her with Hostess, with the Mostess, and
she was a piece of work. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was really quite something. But I mean, supposed toward the end of her life, she had earned it.
Yes.
But you know all the things. So she was Mama Rose in the flesh.
Mm-hmm. As you've done all this incredible research, how do you see his work, you know, from beginning to end in terms of his growth as an artist and a writer?
Well, the development is remarkable. You know, he started out as a sort of a Tin Pan Alley pounder, and by the time his first wife died, he does very clearly say that it's because when I lost you, he was forced to write this song. When she died, his first wife, of typhoid fever, 5 months after they got married, you know, he was writing comedy routines. He was writing joke songs on this, you know. Again, it's Mabel, how do I do it in $5 a week?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, he wrote this ballad for her and realized that she had given him this amazing gift, was that taught him how to write a ballad.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know. You know, he had heard it. It was in the ether, but didn't understand what made a ballad. And the thing about Irving Berlin, he didn't just pop out songs. He thought about them.
Mm-hmm.
He thought about how, he thought about their structure, he thought about how they work, he thought about all those things. And I think that's what makes him enduring and a great artist. It's not just sort of haphazard, a little bit of talent and, oh, this is the fashion nowadays, throw things out. He really worked hard to understand what he was doing and how to do it, and one after the other. It's remarkable.
And then his connection with Ellen Mackey and their romance and an incredible love story. You know, one of, if there was People magazine in that day, it would have been splash.
Well, there sort of was, because they were, not arguably, but realistically, they were the first tabloid couple.
Yes.
Which is sort of shocking, surprising, and sad at the same time.
Mm.
So, you know, that he was this Jewish, you know, to most of the world, no good Nick Waiter, songwriter, nothing from the Lower East Side, and she was the heir to the biggest fortune in America.
I love the story about the party her dad gave, and she was dancing with the Prince of Wales, and that may be noted in the show,
I'm not sure.
And it's just remarkable and wonderful.
Well, it's a very sweet story, you know, that he wasn't invited because he was this Jewish songwriter, and you didn't invite Jewish songwriters, and she wanted to be with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out she was dancing with the prince, the orchestra was playing What'll I Do? You know, so it worked out perfectly, and it's
that's just
causes a great, great bunch of laughs in the show, so mm-hmm. there is that. So.
No, it's great. I mean, his story is remarkable, and I just imagine the audience must enjoy his story as much as the music, and the music's remarkable.
Well, I think the reason to do this tale is because of the story. I mean, you know, people sing this stuff infinitely better than I ever will, but that's not what it is. It's really about the story and the context of the man, and nowadays the context of this story within the context of what's happening to us today,
mm-hmm.
and to realize what it really does mean to be someone who comes to a country and values its values and wants to give back to it instead of take away, you know.
Oh, and he gave back so much. He was a supreme patriot.
And his daughters confirmed for me that it wasn't, not a ruse, but it wasn't a put on. It wasn't this notion of he wanted to advance his career, advance his standing in American society. It was absolutely genuine. He wanted to give back to the country that he felt gave him permission to do everything.
Mm. What became of his siblings? I'm curious. I don't know myself.
There's some were in Europe, some were in Russia, and some were in New York. One brother committed suicide. You know, all kinds of, like any family.
Right.
You know.
Interesting. In your shows, you deeply inhabit songs and stories written decades ago and their connection with the social and political climate of the day. What is your impression of the current Broadway offerings, such as Hamilton, and how do you feel these shows connect with our current times?
How do these shows connect with our current times? Well, I think with any great show that tells a great human story, you can always find something new. And, you know, your perfect example is Shakespeare. It just doesn't go out of fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, style of performance goes out of fashion, but the actual story, if it's a human story, and his is a very human story. I mean, it's still a relationship. I mean, today it's a story about an immigrant, as I've been joking about. You know, if there was a wall that had been built and Irving Berlin would not have been allowed in as a Jewish immigrant from a faraway land, such as Russia or Syria or whatever you want to call it, the Christians wouldn't have anything to sing for Christmas and Easter, you know, because it's his songs. So, I mean, you know, that causes a little bit of laughter. But at the end of the day, I think from a political standpoint is, you know, is democracy is a complicated affair, and it doesn't stop. There isn't an answer. It's something that keeps on rolling out and keeps on changing, and we're in very complicated times now and scary times, and I think he'd see these as scary times because the value is not about one another or even a country. It's the value is me, you know. I deserve, I need, I should have, you know. The country has let me down. And it goes back to even the simplest ask, not, you know, to Kennedy, you know, or Ted Sorensen, you know. Ask not what your country can do for you, you know, ask what you do. And this is a bit of a problem that we're seeing now. It's become the me generation. I deserve, I exist, I deserve, you know, this is not going so well for me, I deserve better. Oh, really? Okay, and why would you do so you deserve better?
It's interesting because I'm a resident artist at another company in town, and we've been thinking about this. The way in which theater comes to us is in a... It's a lot about money. There's so much going on about money and being able to... Obviously, artists need to be paid a living wage, and everyone wants to make a living. And that said, right now it feels as though we're really being charged with taking the lead in telling stories that help people try to leave this me generation and come into a sense of togetherness and helping each other and having love for each other. I'm not crazy about the word tolerance. I've never been crazy about that. Compassion.
Yes, tolerance is a, you know, it's a terrible word.
It is.
It's not a terrible word. It's a polite way of saying, you know, I tolerate, you know. No, people don't have compassion for one another. And it's scary. And, you know, and the people who have pulpits now are encouraging even less compassion and just more hatred. And it's really frightening. And what the theater does... You know, I sort of lost sight of what our responsibility is. I've gone back to the notion that the theater's responsibility is to entertain because the rest of the world is so miserable at this point that we should just come together and have a good time and maybe remember what it is about us that is human, that is
when
kind
we are
and
together.
Gentle when we are together, and that you can put 500 people in a room, obviously each with different political views, regard even if it's they're all in this city leaning to the left, you know, even within among those, you'll have 500 different opinions that can all sing together one song. Actually sound quite good together. You know, and if that's possible, a whole lot of other things are possible. And, you know, the notion that we should be here and not really care about the planet that we're on is a really scary thing. You know, we're going through times where it's just make as much money as fast as possible and screw anybody that, you know, suffers. And you know, there is a social responsibility, and we've lost a sense of social responsibility, you know. And defining social responsibility is also complicated, you know. What are we responsible to help people who can't help themselves, or do we force them to say, you know, help yourself, it's your problem? I mean, it's complicated, it's not easy.
That's the one of the issues, I think, today, that we want to really compartmentalize problems, you know, black and white. These people need help, these people don't. Well, the fact is, you and I are sitting here, and I'm sure there's some things you'd love help with, and same here, but everyone's a snowflake.
Everyone needs it, and it's a terrifying thing. And I think our job really is to remind people that there is more to life than just being miserable and wanting stuff, you know, and that storytelling is ultimately, at the end of all this, 100 years from now, what is going on today is going to be nothing more than a story. If the world doesn't explode or implode, you know, or dry up or burn up or whatever's going to go, you know, with climate change, because that's very real, and to pretend that it isn't is scary.
Yes.
So, you know, it's living in this world where we pretend all kinds of things away is a very frightening thing. And strangely, in theater, we're pretending all of us, and yet we are the actual true reflection of what is going on. So that's an interesting thing, you know?
It must really fill you up to be able to be with these audiences, with these stories, and with this incredible music, and helping people, paving the way for emotion, which I think is part of the issue. People wanting to, fear, of course, makes us harden, and to hear music, it permeates the skin, and it gets into people.
Well, I think, you know, people think, oh, it's going to be okay because, you know, because I have people, we're here together, and it's going to be okay. But I got to tell you, every day brings weird news.
I know. I saw The Pianist at Willesden Lane here, and that show just rocked my world, and my husband and my daughter as well. For those of you who haven't seen it, you'll have another chance
later on the season.
Later in the season, and it is absolutely such an important piece. Not only for the Mona, is it Golubac?
Golubac.
Yeah. Golubac. Her playing is remarkable. Mm. It's just
a lovely piece.
Beautiful piece. It's a remarkable story. It's heartwarming. It's so much more. There are really no words to express. I would just say everybody get and see it. Listen to her play. Hear her story. There's a book as well that you can read that I just gave to a friend the other day. And it's another story that employs music to help people feel. I think if there would be anything I'd want to give people, it would be the opportunity to feel. And it sounds as though the Berlin story is one
it
of those.
It does, and it's what it's supposed to do. And it's nice to have people come here in Portland.
Right.
Well, it's a fun town.
It is. It's a great town.
I'm waiting for the weather to get better, but other than that...
Well, you hit a crazy patch. This is not the norm, but I'm sure everyone's told you that.
Changes.
Yeah. So you're here for another 4 weeks, Tchaikovsky in the day and Berlin in the night, and needless to say...
And Whole Foods at lunch.
Oh, so, yeah. What's your favorite food in Portland, or what have you...
I can't get out. I've got to fit into the costume, so I wish I could try, but,
right.
You know, Whole Foods is a block away. It provides, you know, everything that ails the sick. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, every remedy that ails the sick. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a lovely place, and it's a beautiful theater, and people have been very welcoming and helpful. So it's nice to be here.
Yes, thanks so much for coming, and thanks for talking to me, and I'm looking forward to seeing your
show
next week.
You too. Yeah. Have a good show tonight.
Thank you.